This is The Takeaway. I'm WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez, and today for Tanzina Vega, it's good to have you with us.
The yeas are 57. The nays are 43.
In the big news of the weekend, the Senate voted 57-43 to convict former President Donald Trump of inciting the insurrection on January 6th. However, due to the 67-vote threshold needed for conviction, Trump was acquitted, again, in his second impeachment trial. While the acquittal was seen as likely, seven Republicans broke with their party and voted to convict Trump for inciting the riot at the Capitol building. Even some GOP members who voted against conviction still excoriated the former president's behavior.
This was an intensifying crescendo of conspiracy theories orchestrated by an outgoing president who seemed determined to either overturn the voters' decision or else torch our institutions on the way out.
Later this hour, we'll look at some of the major challenges that lie ahead for the former president now that he's out of office. But we're going to start with another important story that hasn't gotten much attention. Attacks against the Asian American and Pacific Islander population are on the rise across the U.S. In recent weeks, there's been a surge in violent incidents in the Bay Area and beyond, specifically targeting Asian American elders. In San Francisco, an 84-year-old Thai man died after being shoved to the ground during a morning walk. And in nearby Oakland, a 91-year-old man was violently pushed to the ground, unprovoked, in the city's Chinatown. But the recent violence against the AAPI population isn't coming out of nowhere. Since the pandemic started, anti-Asian racism and violence have surged in the U.S., in part fueled by the racist and xenophobic rhetoric and policies that came out of the Trump White House. According to Stop AAPI Hate, an organization tracking racist incidents against Asian Americans, there have been more than 2,800 incidents of anti-Asian discrimination since March. That includes everything from physical violence and verbal harassment to bullying and vandalism. And although it's unclear whether the recent attacks were racially motivated, the pain and fear experienced by the AAPI population is clear. This surge in anti-Asian violence is where we start on The Takeaway today. With me to talk about this is Chris Kwok, a mediator based in New York City and co-executive editor of a new report, A Rising Tide of Hate and Violence Against Asian Americans in New York During COVID-19. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
And also with us is Russell Jung, a professor with the Asian American Studies Department at San Francisco State University and a co-founder of the group Stop AAPI Hate. Russell, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So, Russell, let's start with some of the recent incidents of anti-Asian violence. What's happening in the Bay Area and elsewhere in California?
Well, it's been horrific. You know, during Lunar New Year, the first thing you do is greet your seniors, your elders, and bow to them. And now, instead, what we're seeing are horrific attacks against our senior and elderly population. And there's been a spate of street violence and crime that, again, aren't necessarily racially motivated, but are just creating a fear and anxiety within the Asian American community.
And so you talk about motive. Has there been a motive identified in these attacks?
Not that we know of yet. But what we do know is that in the past year, anti-Asian racism and hate have surged, not only because of the fear of the pandemic, but because of the racist political rhetoric that just has incited hate speech and then hate violence.
And so, Russell, you talked about the Lunar New Year. So this is a chance for many Asian families to gather together. How are the communities responding to these attacks right now?
I think our community has really stood up against the racism and the violence directed towards us. In the Bay Area, over 50 community groups have held rallies the past weekend for to show support of our elders and to heal our communities, to build racial solidarity. So, and across the nation, I've seen celebrities and athletes, high school students, people from all walks of life really rallying to and mobilizing to stop the racism.
And Chris, these kinds of anti-Asian attacks aren't just happening in California, but they're happening across the U.S. So you recently authored a report that was looking at this trend in New York City. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
What we found in 2020 was a ninefold increase in anti-Asian attacks in New York City. And these are just statistics that the NYPD has collected. So we think it's just the tip of the iceberg and that they were actually much more in 2020. And, you know, this concerned us because we are not aware of any prosecutions on the criminal side, nor any resolutions on the civil side of any of these incidents. So we're worried as to where it's leading in New York City as well.
And so can you tell us how this racism manifests itself besides the very violent assaults? What else is the AAPI population experiencing?
It ranges, and it's directed towards like mothers playing with their children at the playground, where other mothers would say, you know, hey, you know, don't play with that Asian, you know, kid, because they're the ones that brought Corona here. So it really runs the gamut, and it's a chilling sort of effect on Asian Americans as they go about their daily lives.
And Russell, is that a similar experience in California for the Asian community?
Yeah, it's clear. People are targeting what they perceive are vulnerable populations. Women are harassed 2.4 times more than men. Youth and elderly are disproportionately represented in our reports.
And what is this doing to people's mental health, Russell?
Oh, it's had a severe impact. Not only are Asian Americans concerned about getting COVID, they're concerned about their elderly parents. We live in more multi-generational households than the rest of the nation. We're concerned about our livelihood. And then the racism compounds the stress and anxiety. So Asian Americans are the racial group experiencing the most depression, anxiety, and from the racism, racial trauma during COVID-19.
And so, Russell, there has been some arrests in California, at least one arrest. Is that person being charged with a hate crime?
No, not necessarily. Hate crimes, again, are incidents where you can be arrested and where there's racial bias that's been demonstrated. And again, these incidents seemingly are unprovoked and there aren't witnesses to hear what the person said, so you can't tell if it was racially motivated or not. We do know in our incidents that have been reported, about one-third include racist statements when the perpetrators say things like, go back home, you effing chink, or it's because of you and your people we have the coronavirus. So people are using racist language and racial slurs to attack us.
And Chris, how is the NYPD responding?
Well, they created an anti-Asian task force, and, you know, we applaud them for that. And, you know, our recommendation was that they go further along. They made it permanent recently, but we think that, you know, right now it's a volunteer task force, which means that the detectives are serving full time on another role and then take this on a volunteer basis. We think it should be a full-time assignment and the commander be given a budget and have this, you know, sort of exist until there's no need for it.
And Chris, do you believe that a lot of these incidents are going unreported?
Absolutely. You know, there's a big language disconnect between the police and Asian American populations, particularly ones who don't speak English well. And, you know, there is, I think, a general feeling that if you report it, it's not going to go anywhere. It's going to be extremely time consuming. So we have specific recommendations that we think might make it easier, you know, for these reports to be taken seriously.
And Russell, are racist crimes against the AAPI population historically underreported?
Yeah, they've been historically underreported for the same reasons Chris mentioned, language access, thinking it's not going to do any good. It's clear that we're receiving much more reports than the police are. including physical assaults. So people are reporting to us because we have 12 different languages, we're a trusted community partner, and because people feel like they don't necessarily want to criminalize people, but our people, our respondents want a collective voice just to stop it from happening to others.
And for either of you, what's the media coverage been like? Have these attacks been getting much attention from mainstream media?
I mean, I think that they have been covered, particularly in the beginning, which was like in March of 2020, and then it petered out during BLM. And then I think that social media, you know, in the recent sort of death of the Thai American, you know, social media really, I think, began to ring the bell. And then I think it's made its way into sort of mass media. So I think that, you know, that the social media and Asian Americans on Facebook and Twitter have really sort of remade it an issue during this, I think, second wave.
Right. There's been some celebrities who have stepped in and tried to highlight these incidents. Russell, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, even though, you know, these thousands of cases are really horrific and traumatizing, I've been actually heartened to see the Asian American community stand up and mobilize at this moment. So we're seeing people from all walks of life, celebrities, athletes, but also, you know, high school students, data scientists, working with Stop AAPI Hate to address this racism and to call for racial solidarity at this moment.
Right. Wasn't there an Asian American graphic designer who created sort of a portrait of one of the men who died?
Right. That's one of the images that have gone viral. And like Chris said, Asian Americans are using the platforms that they have, social media, alternative media, to get the word out, to stand up, and to mobilize our communities. It's been an amazing movement, actually, from the Asian American perspective.
Right, right. You know, early on in the pandemic, there was some reporting about the financial toll on Chinatowns across the U.S. We've got about a minute before we need to take a break. But Chris, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, before the shutdown in March of 2020, the financial you know, hit was felt by Chinese restaurants because people felt if you could avoid Chinatown, you could avoid Chinese restaurants, you avoided COVID-19. In New York City. And so Chinese restaurants began to experience a dramatic decrease in business early on. And after the pandemic hit and the PPP loans came, they had enormous difficulty in accessing federal loans. And in New York City, there's been difficulty in accessing emergency loans. So it's a real crisis in Chinatown.
Russell, are businesses in California also experiencing this?
We've seen in news media accounts that Chinatowns globally have been down 50 to 75%. Like Chris said, people were shunning and avoiding Chinatowns before shelter in place occurred. And so our Asian businesses have shut down sooner than other businesses. And we have really high rates of joblessness within the Asian American community. It's going to be really difficult to recover after the pandemic.
Right. So during the pandemic, we haven't just seen racism at the individual level, but there's also in terms of actual policy. So can you remind us what we saw under the Trump administration last year, Russell?
Yeah, beyond the interpersonal violence that we experienced, the political rhetoric translated into interpersonal violence and also racist policies. The Trump administration actually stopped migration. And so that stops families from reuniting. He banned Chinese scientists and researchers. He banned WeChat, the major Chinese online platform. He banned racial sensitivity trainings in the federal government. So a lot of my talks were canceled just because I talked about race. He cut refugee resettlement. He cut H-1B visas. So all these policies had a disproportionate impact on the Asian American community, our ability to see our families, our ability to communicate with our families, and our ability to do business. They were actual infringement of our constitutional rights.
And so, Chris, have you seen any difference since Joe Biden took over as president?
I think I've felt the difference. You know, political leadership, it's so important. And I think people, you know, maybe that didn't understand it before, now understand what it is when President Biden, you know, signed that executive order on January 26th of this year. I mean, it was symbolic, but symbols matter in politics. And I think Asian Americans across the country, you know, breathed a sigh of relief, you know, through the executive action, was said, we won't use no more racist language. Let's not call it a Chinese flu. And if there's anything, we should draw it back a little bit. And people felt the difference. I know I did.
Right, right. And so moving forward, what else do you want to see from the federal government?
I mean, I think the federal government needs to be really engaged in the leadership position from this. You know, the state and city governments are a lot closer to sort of everyday life. But the federal response with political leadership from Kamala Harris, Biden, signaling sort of what they have and then putting that into action through the federal government sort of bureaucracy, leading talks, making sure that crimes are being, hate crimes are being prosecuted, that there's also a civil resolution component through mediation of these things. It can play a really effective leadership role here.
And so, Russell, in California, does the Asian community want perpetrators to be charged with hate crimes?
There's a range of responses. What Stop AAPI Hate is calling for is more restorative justice. Like Chris mentioned, we're working with the Department of Fair Employment and Housing to promote mediation and to expand our civil rights protections. Again, most of our incidents that we're experiencing aren't necessarily hate crimes, but hate incidents where we're getting verbally harassed, where we're getting barred from establishments. And so what we want are expanded protections and safe access to goods and services. We want public accommodations. So again, Stop AAPI Hate, we're working with the DFEH to encourage people to pursue that remedy. We're holding a seminar in multiple languages to encourage people to fight for their rights. And we think that's probably a better way to address a lot of these issues.
So you mentioned mediation. Can you talk about that a little bit? How do you envision that?
Well, Chris is a mediator, so we learn
true.
A lot
that's
from
true.
Him. But for example, if customers are harassing one another, an Asian American can complain to a corporation, file a complaint about the corporation's lack of protection, and the corporation could put up better signage, could train its employees, can work out, could provide financial restitution to a targeted Asian American. So that type of mediation, again, doesn't necessarily criminalize the racist person, but it works to hold that individual accountable, hold the corporations accountable, but also provides healing and reconciliation for the targeted person.
And so, Chris, Russell's right. You're the mediator. Do you want to tackle that question as well?
Yeah. You know, like during the 60s, the Department of Justice, you know, created something called the Community Relations Service. And not a lot of people know about it, but it's a great, it's a community mediation service where mediators come into communities that are, you know, in the middle of a conflict and sit down with groups and try to find some way out of that sort of, you know, conflict point. And that's one of the, you know, wonderful things that the federal government can put into action. It was really, it suffered a lot during the Trump administration in terms of funding, things like that. But it can really be put to good use. It's already there.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Russell Jung is a professor of the Asian American Studies Department at San Francisco State University and co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate. And Chris Kwok is a mediator based in New York City and co-executive editor of a new report, A Rising Tide of Hate and Violence Against Asian Americans in New York During COVID-19. Thank you both for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The yeas are 57. The nays are 43.
After former President Donald Trump was acquitted on Saturday, several of his former Republican allies who voted to acquit still condemned Trump for his role in the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Their statements are likely to ring hollow for anyone hoping to see the Senate hold Trump accountable. But speaking on the Senate floor after the acquittal vote, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell argued that Trump can still be punished through the courts.
President Trump is still liable for everything he did while he was in office as an ordinary citizen. Unless the statute of limitations is run, still liable for everything he did while he's in office. Didn't get away with anything yet. Yeah. We have a criminal justice system in this country. We have civil litigation, and former presidents are not immune from being accountable by either one.
Going forward, Donald Trump could face a range of potential legal challenges for actions that extend far beyond the Capitol insurrection. Who better to break this all down than Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast from WNYC and ProPublica, and author of American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Cindy. It's so great to talk to you on the show.
Likewise. So we've got a lot of ground to cover here. So there's been some reporting that the Washington, D.C. Attorney General is considering whether to bring charges against Trump for his role in the Capitol insurrection. What can you tell us about that case?
So, I mean, there isn't a case yet, but we do know that the Attorney General of the District of Columbia, Carl Racine, has said that it is possible that the president could be charged, that he could charge the president in connections with his actions on January 6th. Nothing has happened yet, nor has anything happened with the federal prosecutors in Washington who, as we know, have indicted dozens of individuals so far in connections with their actions and seem to be proceeding at a pretty rapid pace. So it was interesting that during the impeachment trial, Trump's lawyers gestured to the federal prosecutors in Washington as what they said was the appropriate forum to handle possible repercussions for the former president. So we shall see if it ever came to that, what Trump's lawyers would argue then. If passed as prologue, I suspect that they would say that is also not an appropriate venue, which seems to be one of their standard defenses in all of the different litigation and legal troubles Trump has faced over the years.
Right. So now we can jump to Georgia, mm-hmm. where there's an investigation regarding Donald Trump's call to Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, where Trump asked him to find the votes to tip the state's election in his favor. Is that investigation still ongoing?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first real criminal investigation we know of that stem from former President Trump's post-election actions. And we know that last week, the district attorney there, Fulton County, sent out letters to a number of state officials requesting information about their interactions with former President Trump and also associates. So while that case has only just begun, it could, in theory, if they decide they have the evidence to make out criminal charges, be a case that proceeds pretty quickly. It's not a complex financial investigation. It doesn't involve any Russian or foreign actors. It just involves things that happen in a discrete period of time. And, you know, as we know, lots of criminal investigations proceed rapidly. So even though it's just happened, if the district attorney decides to go forward, and of course President Trump has said that there is no crime that was committed there, then that could be something that could resolve itself fairly rapidly.
Okay. And then, Andrea, there's also these investigations looking into the spending practices of Trump's inaugural committee. Why are they being investigated?
So this is something that actually stemmed out of work that we did in our podcast, where we found my colleague Ilya Meretz actually found an email exchange with Ivanka Trump and members of the inaugural committee about the prices that the Trump Hotel was charging during the last inaugural, the one that happened in 2017 when Trump became mm-hmm. president. And Trump team was advised that they were overcharging, and they went ahead and did it anyway, and that could be a violation of charities laws. And this is an investigation also by the D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine, and it is quite far along. Now, it's a civil investigation, and it doesn't involve Trump, but it does involve his inaugural committee from the last time around.
I see. Now, as you've mentioned, Trump Inc. has reported extensively on Donald Trump's personal finances. Where do things stand on the Manhattan District Attorney's possible case against Trump?
Yes. Yeah, so this is a case that is both very far along and caught up in the Supreme Court for a second time. This is the case where the Manhattan District Attorney started investigating Trump's business practices from before he was president and whether he had committed bank fraud, tax fraud, insurance fraud, and other financial violations. And Trump, when he got wind of this, sued the district attorney to prevent him from getting his tax returns. And that case went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled against Trump, and his lawyers brought it back to the Supreme Court on different grounds, claiming the subpoenas were overly broad. And that is where it is now. Everyone thought the case would be dismissed in January after Trump no longer was president, but that hasn't happened. So although by all reports and from everything we can glean, the district attorney's investigation is intensive, serious, it is stymied by not having those tax returns. The next decision date is at the end of this month, and it may be that he gets those documents then, in which case he could proceed, if he thinks there's evidence, with indictments of Trump, his associates, or his business.
Okay, so that's one case that stems out of New York. There's another case that's with Attorney General Letitia James. She's also pursuing a civil case against the Trump Organization. Right. What is the latest there?
Exactly. It's about whether the Trump Organization lied when they valued their properties in order to avoid paying New York state taxes. That's a civil case. There's also separate civil litigation brought by private parties. So there is a lot of litigation facing Trump and his business going forward that we expect to see some sort of resolution in the courts around.
Okay, Andrea, what's Trump's legal strategy been while he was president? And you sort of already explained some of that, but will that continue to be his strategy going forward?
Yes, I expect so. I mean, when the House tried to investigate him, he said, no, they're trying to act like law enforcement groups. When the Manhattan DA, a law enforcement officer, tried to investigate him, he said, you can't investigate a sitting president. We saw during the impeachment trial, they said, well, he's not now president anymore, so we can't impeach him. This is the wrong venue charge. This is not appropriate. It's something I expect to see going forward, as well as what we've always heard. Trump, when he's cornered, says these investigations are politically motivated.
Andrea, thank you so much for that rundown. Andrea Bernstein is the co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast from WNYC and ProPublica. Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you, Cindy. Great to talk to you.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Cindy Rodriguez. At the end of January, a series of violent actions by school resource officers against Black students in Central Florida were caught on camera, leading to an outcry in the local education system. In one incident, at a high school in Eustis, Florida, an officer who had been trying to break up a cafeteria fight tased a student, knocking her to the ground. According to local television station WFTV, the officer is not being punished for his actions, but the student has been charged for allegedly hitting the officer. In another, at Liberty High School in Osceola County, Florida, an officer body slammed a 16-year-old girl, knocked her unconscious, and then handcuffed her. The officer is currently under investigation, but on paid leave. Now, a number of students and other local organizers are calling for the removal of armed resource officers from all Florida schools. With us to discuss this are two of those students, Valeria Perez. She's a student at Osceola County School for the Arts and president of its March for Our Lives chapter. And also with us is Ariana Brown, student at Lake Sumter State College in Lake County, Florida. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Valeria, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your high school and what's your interaction with the school resource officers like?
Yeah, so I'm from Kissimmee, Florida. So even right now, my interaction with the officer is very minimal. The only time really me and my peers see them, fortunately, is parked outside of our school. And when we walk into school, sometimes they'll like walk into the building and walk out. But there's really no interaction or patrolling ever. We just see them really residing by their cars. But definitely my experience being on campus with the officer present is different. Peers who are Black and my friends who were at the school board meeting with me even talked about how they feel like they have to hide like their true presence and tone down their personality because they never know how an officer or the one we have on school that day may perceive them. And that's obviously incredibly disheartening because no student should have to go to school every day feeling threatened or feeling that they have to adjust themselves because they never know what situation they might be put in, like those students were.
And Ariana, you're in college now, but you also have had experiences with school resource officers and have spoken out. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I actually went to a private school, and at my school, we didn't have student resource officers. We only had volunteers that would come in and watch our campus. And this is why I advocate for this problem, because if we can do it for private schools and have people actually there to help students and actually protect them rather than harm them in certain situations, then we should be advocating for them to change the SROs and have them there to be more of guardians rather than people to fear or be scared of when you're at school. If I could go to high school and graduate freely, then people in public schools should be able to do the same thing.
And so, Valeria, these videos that we mentioned earlier, what was the reaction at your high school?
It was incredibly emotionally overwhelming for a lot of my peers and just extremely alarming, because seeing a grown man be able to body slam a child is scary. And I think what was even more disheartening was the reaction from school board officials, from the police department, because there never really seemed to be this prioritization around the student's safety and her needs, because no officer in that position of power should be able to slam a child like that and be able to go back to work the same day and not face punishments at the stakes that the students are facing even.
Tell us a little bit how you envision that in your school.
I think what a lot of that looks like is prioritizing really the safety of students. And I think a big conversation that's been happening for a while when we look at that is defunding the police, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement this summer, protesting the need for it, mainly because there's so much money being allocated towards officers. We basically want to reallocate the money that's going to officers back into restorative justice programs and into mental health services and services for teachers, mainly because when we have officers in schools, they're mainly used in this position for extreme measures like mass shootings, when in reality, they've proven to be more harmful than helpful on a daily basis because they're threatening the lives of students. And we've seen this repetitive use of excessive force in other schools throughout the years. So really, when you look at it, we want to make sure that we are prioritizing the needs of students on a day-to-day basis. And what that looks like is investing these resources back into services that help students. So for example, a study done by the ACLU actually talks about how there are 1.7 million in students in schools with police officers, but no counselors. And this is as recent as 2019. And even 3 million students are in schools with police, but no nurses. And 6 million students are in schools with police officers, but no social workers. And when you hear the numbers, it's just incredibly alarming that why would we not have mental health counselors to help out with the needs of students that police officers are there in place to prevent or there to treat, especially because we've realized that police officers in schools aren't as good at de-escalating situations like mental health counselors are. So when we use these counselors and when we reallocate that money towards services like restorative justice programs to deal with the needs of students in those situations, we're able to not only create a safer learning environment, but also be able to teach kids how the real world works and respect their needs and respect their boundaries and their safety in school.
And Ariana, you just said that you went to a private high school. Did your private high school have some of these things that Valeria is speaking about?
We did have counselors, more or less like a student guidance counselor that was always there for us. Like, we were really close with the students, not only also because of the fact that it was a smaller school, but we always had our coaches and our teachers, like they were our counselors. They were taught how to like talk to us whenever we needed help, or even the volunteers that would be the security guards around campus, like they would have conversations with us and like actually be there and make it feel like they're not there for us, but they're actually there because they are protecting us and making us feel safer, not making us feel like our lives are threatened every day that we go to school.
And Valeria, what has been the response from school officials so far to your demands?
Basically, what we understand is the school board stated that they understand the severity of the situation, that of course they wouldn't, obviously that situation is frightening. And actually what we heard when we were at the protests, my peers and I, was we had a school board member come up to us and he told us that there is this committee that he was organizing to rediscuss the policies related to school resource officers.
That was Valeria Perez, a student at Osceola County School for the Arts and president of its March for Our Lives chapter, and Ariana Brown, a student at Lake Sumter College in Lake County, Florida. Valeria, Ariana, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
The presence of a police officer in a school is not an anomaly for high schools in Florida. Nearly half of all schools in the U.S. have a school resource officer stationed there. And while a few members of Congress have vowed to place more police officers in schools around the country for security, some experts say it is better to remove police officers from school. With me now is Christopher Mallett, a professor of social work at Cleveland State University, and he's been studying the prevalence of school resource officers nationwide. Chris, thank you for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me. Nice to be back.
So, Chris, let's break down some basics. What's the difference between a school resource officer and a regular police officer?
Normally, in most school districts, nothing. SROs, as they're commonly referred to, are 95 times out of 100 officers from your local police district. They're simply contracted to be housed, basically, at the schools. And okay. Often they go from one school to the next.
So they're within the PDs in different localities. But what about, do they carry guns? What sort of weapons do they carry, if they carry any?
Yeah, it depends. Normally they're going to be fully armed unless there's an agreement between the district and the police district to change that. But they're fully ready officers at all times.
Okay. And what are their duties?
Well, most of the time, it is law enforcement. Many school districts will try to expand that role, and maybe a small percentage, 40% or so of the police officers will do other roles, such as maybe mentoring, maybe teach a class on safety, some of the ALICE trainings, but primarily it's law and order.
Okay. And I don't want to downplay the importance of safety, because it's very important for students to feel safe. In order for them to show up to school every day. But when you saw those videos, what was your reaction to the videos, and could they have been handled differently?
Yeah, I think they can. Every so often, a couple times a year, we get a video like that that comes out that sparks the national outcry, as it should, because there's no reason that any minor misbehavior or even a major misbehavior should lead to what we saw a couple weeks ago in Florida. Unfortunately, my reaction was that I've seen this for many years periodically, and that the attention comes, but then it actually leaves. And there is not much change or permanent change other than the reaction to the event.
How should these situations be handled?
Most of the time, any incident on campus is not as serious or a violent threat. So it could be handled by school personnel, mental health counselors, school counselors. But the presence of a police officer really does change that dynamic most of the time.
And so I don't know if you heard the preceding interview, but one of the students talked about shifting resources away from the SROs to things like having guidance counselors or mental health services at schools. Is that something that you advocate for as well?
I would in almost all circumstances. It's pretty rare that you have an actual serious crime problem on a school campus. And in those cases, which again are rare, a police officer may be a good choice. But 95% of the time, that's not going to be your best option. And there's a lot of dollars that go towards in a school budget paying for SROs. And it probably is much better to shift or start to the conversation to shift those dollars to mental health work, prevention work, violence prevention, because they really do work with young people.
And is this conversation happening amongst lawmakers or others?
It was last summer. You had, after the George Floyd incident, you had 7 or 8 school districts that did discontinue their contracts with police departments, and they don't have police officers on campus anymore. San Francisco, Denver, a few others. Chicago and LA talked about it, but didn't do it. But since then, the movement or that conversation has really died. And so the impetus seems to have left policymakers since that time.
And you haven't seen, do these videos reignite that conversation?
Well, they do, in the sense that we're talking about it now and others are. Will it lead to lasting conversation or any amendments to the use of police officers on campus? I don't know. I was more optimistic last year, but the poll for Law and Order, sort of that perception of what it means, even though the evidence isn't there, is pretty strong in most communities. So I don't know.
And have you looked at where SROs get placed? And do they get placed in schools that are predominantly black and brown schools versus white schools?
They're disproportionately in schools that are majority black and brown. Yes. And they're disproportionately then in schools that are in poor school districts also.
And so you've been looking at this issue for how many years, would you say?
Oh, I've been writing, researching, and looking at it for about 15 years, and I've been involved with young people in schools and in various roles for about 25.
I see. And do you see any difference in the conversation today versus even 5 years ago?
We didn't have this conversation as strongly 5 years ago. So in that sense, maybe there's a hope. But I'm optimistic about schools and how they've handled change with keeping kids in school. I'm optimistic about the juvenile justice system itself moving toward rehabilitation. But this one issue seems to really be tough. And so time will tell. We'll keep my optimism, but I don't think I'm hopeful.
Well, Chris, we're going to leave it there. Christopher Mallett is a professor of social work at Cleveland State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's the show, folks. It was so nice to be back with you. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you missed anything or want to listen back again, check out our podcast. You can download it wherever you find your podcasts or head over to thetakeaway.org. If you have any thoughts or ideas for the show, send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And you can find me at Cynrod. That's at CYNROD. We can also take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Leave us your take right here. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Cindy Rodriguez in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.